May it please the Court, my name is Jefferson Coulter, and I'm representing the appellant, Strangman Lantern Company. We're here today to appeal a preliminary injunction that was issued in the Western District of Washington. We believe that the court sitting in the Western District of Washington improperly applied the doctrine of patent prosecution history itself. We believe that the improperly disregarded evidence of patent misuse and possible invalidity. And we believe that this court should reverse it and send it back to be considered in light of the...
It seems pretty apparent that the district court here was worried about factual evidence of overt copying.
Overt copying. We did discuss...
How does the district court deal with that sort of evidence?
In terms of direct copying, they were very persuaded by the fact that the lanterns looked similar. But this isn't a design patent, this is a utility patent. And we're talking about the functionality of the two devices. Most Trainman lanterns, in fact all Trainman lanterns, look pretty much the same. The question in this, if I may take these, the question in the case before this court, and before that court as well, was whether they contained the same claims and limitations, and they do not. This would be what they refer to as the prototype, which is their original Trainman lantern, which contains...
You're saying that's the embodiment of the patent?
Yes, it's the embodiment of the patent by AG Design Company. They came up with this Trainman lantern that contains quartz and reflector. And this, I will note, this lantern, their prototype, is marked patents pending 1999. We'll get to that in just a moment. This is what they refer to as their patented device, which is a training lantern. Looks very similar to all other training lanterns with...
Just for the record, what's the number on that one so it's distinguished from the other orange one?
The patented device is A550. The prototype device is marked A552. The accused device made by my clients is marked A551. This is a training lantern that does not contain quartz in the reflector, which was an essential limitation of the both independent claims in the patent as issued.
So what claims is your client accused of infringing?
Well, that's the funny thing. He doesn't seem to be accused of infringing any of the claims. He seems to be accused of performing the same function as the patented devices.
Well, what claims are at issue?
We were unable to determine that from the ruling at the district court level. We believe it has to do with the production of bright lateral illumination.
Well, which was the claim that was amended?
We're talking about claim 1 and claim 12. Both of them are independent. In the original application, the inventor claimed a Trainman lantern with an inner and outer reflective surface that provided lateral bright illumination and up illumination. And that was rejected as being anticipated by prior art, because there already existed many training lanterns.
That was the Lewis reference.
Yes, that was the Lewis reference. And Lewis references a product made by AG's primary competitor, Coatstar Lantern and Headlight Company. It was rejected for that, but the patent examiner said that he would allow it if they were to include quartz and reflector as an essential limitation of both independent claims, which they did. As the patent application was filed, this would have clearly been infringing, as with all Trainman lanterns that are currently in existence. Because he intentionally entered a narrowing amendment that limited both independent claims, he can't come back now later under the doctrine of patent prosecution history estoppel and claim and try to recapture these elements that he's already given up.
Can I move you just before time runs up to a couple of extraneous issues? One is that the patent misuse argument you make in your brief,
yes,
the district court judge didn't say anything about it. Was that issue raised before the district court?
We did raise it in both our opening brief to the district court and in our closing brief, and we asked for reconsideration also on that issue. And then the reconsideration was mooted because we stayed the effectivity of the preliminary injunction.
But did you raise, I mean, I know you referenced, I saw some reference to it in the record below, that, but it didn't seem to me that the argument was necessarily made. I mean, this was one of your allegations. I mean, you clearly made the allegation to this court.
We did, and it was in our opening brief. We claimed that they were, my recollection was that it's in our opening brief.
And then another unrelated issue, which is that the seems to me that one could read the district court's decision on the PI to have an alternative ground, which is the serious question raised on the covenant not to compete.
Mm-hmm.
And if that were so, then you haven't appealed that. So why, even if we buy everything you say with respect to validity or prosecution history estoppel, would we still have to affirm the PI on that alternative ground?
Because the covenant not to compete has expired, and so it would be moot as an issue for the trial court. I'm sorry, am I answering the correct question?
Yes, so...
The covenant not to compete would have expired at the absolute latest in late 2007. My client states that they're basing that issue on his last royalty check as an independent contractor, which means that the covenant not to compete, which went for 3 years, would have ended in 2006.
Was the Q's device created during the time that the covenant not to compete was in force?
No, not by the evidence that my client has presented.
But is that a question of fact?
It certainly is a question of fact.
And could the district court resolve that question of fact on the likelihood standard against you and found, as he apparently does, reading exactly the sentences that Judge Prost just cited you to, seems to have decided that issue against you?
It appears that way, but it seems that the primary...
It appears. What do we do with this language which says, accordingly, because a serious question is raised on that, this is another basis for preserving the status quo pending final resolution. Another basis for the injunction.
But he's not preserving the status quo. He was attempting to change the status quo. And we presented...
Change it because the covenant had expired?
Because the covenant had expired. So we were presenting evidence that it had not...
But if the covenant had been violated by the creation of this lantern during its pendency, isn't the district court entitled to perceive that there may be a contractual issue that warrants an injunction?
They would be entitled to, based on the evidence, that's what was demonstrated. But we don't believe that it was demonstrated to the trial court. So another possible issue of error for a Washington substantive question. It's a Washington covenant not to compete. So it was we took supplemental jurisdiction of the Washington issues,
which is appropriate.
Which was
and
certainly
we
appropriate.
We have jurisdiction over that in our court,
right?
Mr. Cole, yes, I'm trying. There was a preliminary injunction issue. Then it was removed, and the restraint was imposed on both parties.
It was very odd, but it was issued. We moved for reconsideration or to stay. And then we were to stay.
Yeah.
And we didn't receive a ruling, so we moved for an appeal. Then the reconsideration was granted, and a briefing schedule was set, and then it was transferred to a different judge.
So a stay was entered?
A stay was entered.
So a stay was entered with the PI, and then what happened?
It was transferred to another judge, the reconsideration was mooted, it was statistically terminated, and then plaintiff below requested that the court reopen it to issue an order telling my client to stop making false representations about the status of the case.
Right.
And his representations were a little bit inaccurate, but from a layperson's point of view, he stated that...
Well, what did the district court do?
The district court reopened it and then put an injunction against both parties preventing, well, first of all, the original judge took it back, and then the district court, that judge, prohibited both parties from discussing or marketing the land further. And then the plaintiff moved for reconsideration of that, which was granted without our opportunity to respond. And then it was limited to just my client not being permitted to discuss the land trade. But the stay was lifted.
But I'm trying to discuss or market the land trade.
It was discussed or market the land. Well, to not make false representations about the status of the case.
But what I'm trying to understand is there a preliminary injunction in place?
We're not clear, Your Honor. We think that the stay is still in effect because it wasn't lifted. Procedurally, it's just very unusual, and we don't know where we stand.
Let me go back to the point that I raised and Judge Rader raised about this covenant not to sue. Your first response was that that's expired now.
It is expired.
So is your argument that it's therefore we shouldn't, there's no PI in order in any event? I mean, most they could be getting damages for that, but prospectively there's no reason for a preliminary injunction? That wouldn't provide basis for a preliminary injunction because it's no longer in effect. Is that what you're trying to argue? Or
what I'm saying is I think that if there was a valid non-compete in effect, then it could be basis for PI. But the non-compete expired before my client began developing the product. They argued that the non-compete ends when he received his last royalty check. He stated that the non-compete expired when he quit. And there's a 2.5 year difference around that issue.
But the judge seems, you can see that the judge made a finding for the other side and not for you on that factual question?
I can see that he sort of threw it in at the end, but it seems the main issue had to do with the patent.
And so do you dispute the fact that you've got a problem here even if you prevail on the two issues you've appealed?
I don't believe that we will have any problem on that issue because we're far past the non-compete period.
Under anyone's view?
Under anyone's view. Even under plaintiff's view, we're past that period.
So you're saying even if there was a violation, the only remedy now would be damages?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And when was the date that you say that even everybody will agree with a particular date? The date of the PI decision was July 2007. When are you saying that?
I believe, Your Honor, it is November of 2007 would have been the absolute end date pled by the plaintiff.
Save the rest of your time.
I would, Your Honor. Thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Bob Christie. I'm the attorney for AG Design, a small company headed by Alan Harrington, who is truly an American inventor, an inventor of the device, the patent device that's at issue here.
Well, let's get quickly to the issue.
I'm going to answer very specifically the questions that the court raises during the argument, because I think I have the answers to those. You asked Judge Rader, how do you deal with the district court's concern that there was overcopying, and clearly the judge made factual findings supported by evidence, and there's no persuasive argument that those can be overturned here. In fact, what is interesting is that there was one expert
that
testified.
But he's entitled to copy something that's in the public domain.
He's not entitled to infringe a patent, and if the court looks at these two devices, they are virtually identical down to the micron, with the exception of one aspect.
Claims. The claims require ports. There are no ports on the accused device. Therefore, you have to go with the doctrine of equivalence.
That is correct.
And the only way your doctrine of equivalence can apply is if you recapture the same ground you surrendered to distinguish your patented invention over the Lewis prior art.
Well,
Lewis prior, you had to put in the ports limitation to get past the Lewis prior art. Therefore, you cannot ignore that limitation. Prosecution history estoppel will prevent you from using the doctrine of equivalence. You're cooked on patent infringement, right?
I disagree with that entirely, and we certainly have an argument that there is a rebuttal to that presumption based on the tangential
exception. The court has certainly underscored
that that's a very narrow exception.
And I read all of the court's opinions.
But it wouldn't apply in this case anyway, because this is right on all fours. You're trying to recapture the port limitation, which was inserted in the patent to escape the very prior art that the accused device is similar to. You could, tangential is when the amendment is on a kind of completely different subject than what the equivalent is. But in this case, ports or no ports, it's pretty, there's no tangentiality here.
Well, I'm not going to pretend to educate this court on that doctrine, because you've well articulated, and I've read your comments concerning your view of that being very narrow. I've also read Judge Post's recent decision that speaks directly to that issue. I think there was an argument presented, and this judge found that there was sufficient proof by us of likelihood to prevail.
But the problem is, the question now is there vulnerability? We've said, I think Amazon.com versus Barnes & Noble says that in a PI setting, is there a showing of some vulnerability on an issue? And here, certainly given what Judge Rader's explained and stated with respect to the record on prosecution history, he gave it up. And there's no, I think whatever the scope of the tangentiality doctrine is, I think it's correct. It doesn't apply in this case.
Well, I do agree that whatever the scope of the tangentiality exception is, I don't think you can use it to recapture. We didn't argue that before.
And that's the problem here. I mean, in essence, it does recapture what was given up. Because, you know, Lewis didn't have any ports. The examiner said with respect to Claim 6, you can effectively amend, and you did to put in the ports, and now you're trying to go back there. I mean, I think that's the problem. I think you're correct on that.
I would disagree that is the root of the problem in terms of the patent issue here. But I want to answer the court's other questions which you raised, because it is significant, and you've hit the nail on the head. There is a completely alternative ground that Judge Burgess relied on.
Yeah, but why not significant now? Did you mention that in your brief at all?
Well, it hasn't even been raised on this appeal. He has not challenged that. So whatever this court does...
Well, he could have done, which was what I thought of, and I may very well be wrong, it was just tentative, was to say, to argue in your brief, even if he is correct on the issues he's appealed, alternatively, that still leaves the injunction, the PI in place with respect to the coming not to sue. You didn't say it right.
I'm going to say it right now, Your Honor. I didn't say that in my red brief, but clearly that issue has not been appealed here in the court.
Why isn't your remedy for the covenant not to sue limited to damages at this point? Because the covenant has expired.
Well, the covenant has expired.
So that puts back into the public domain. You can use things. If there is a contractual violation, the remedy would be damages, right?
Well, one remedy is clearly damages. The development of this accused device, there is no dispute in this record that it was all done well within the time frame of the covenant not to compete. We had our hearing on in June, and we got our order in July.
So you get damages for any that flow from that contractual violation. But why should we grant an injunction when the contract is expired?
This is what you should do. You should not disturb Judge Burgess's decision on the supplemental state law claims to impose an injunction. You should not disturb that. That is not an issue that has been framed and presented to you in this case. The only injunctive relief framed and presented to you is that which he entered alternatively on
the
patent.
And on the basis of that, then, we could reverse, right? If we are convinced that the one issue before us does not support the injunction, then we would say there is no support for the injunction.
On that ground. But you would not vacate the injunction to the extent that the judge...
You raised that at the point.
You shouldn't disturb it, I guess is my point, Your Honor. It has not been framed, it has not been raised in this case.
But the point is, though, Mr. Christie, if the contract, covenant not to sue, has expired, how can anybody be enjoined? Again, you may well, I don't know, you may well have a very good claim for damages, you may not, but anyway, in any event, it's a damages issue.
Well, I'm always careful when I'm addressing issues in the appellate court to talk about what issues have been framed and presented to you. And candidly and frankly, the issue relating to this contract is not one that's been challenged. It's not one that's been framed for this appeal. So
well, it can't be a basis for an injunction. If the contract is expired, do you agree if a contract is expired, someone cannot be enjoined from acting a certain way under the contract because it doesn't exist anymore?
Well, under Washington law and under the principles of equity that Judge Burgess would bring to bear on that question, I don't completely agree with that, Your Honor. I think
but
there's
how could that be? If a contract exists, I could be enjoined from not performing. But if a contract no longer exists, how can anyone say what I can or can't do under something that doesn't exist?
If during the term of that contract you actively violated by competing, are you to be rewarded on the basis of there being no equitable remedy by violating that contract, competing in the same narrow market in which my client is competing?
No, you're hitting with damages.
Well, clearly that is a remedy. I'm just, for purposes of this appeal, I'm not going to totally concede that there couldn't be, under Washington law, which is what we're talking about on this supplemental
claim.
But
you do concede that the district court never was faced with that issue. Presumably he issued this PI, assuming that he relied on this alternative ground. The PI was issued at the time of covenant not to sue, at least in your view, was still in the same.
That's right, Your Honor. The issue of mootness that counsel's just raised in this issue of expiration has never been framed for Judge Burgess, nor has it been part of any reconsideration before him.
Notwithstanding my and other questions to Mr. Coulter about the alternative ground, is it that what the district court judge, let me argue the other side to you, which is all the district court judge said was there's a serious question. Is a finding even undisturbed that by a district court judge that there's a serious question as to whether or not they violated the covenant to sue sufficient grounds for a PI?
Well, I think that it is. I think in the context of what was presented, if you look both at his order as well as looking at the underlying record from the hearing, this judge was very disturbed by the testimony presented by Mr. Mackay when he was faced with his signature on a covenant not to compete, where he denied that it was affixed to the document when he signed it. And the judge, I think, tries to, without being too blunt, express in here his disbelief with Mr. Mackay's testimony and his clear finding that this is the product of reverse engineering that came about as a result of an agency relationship where Mr. Mackay was literally working for my client, obtaining all of the confidential information
I
had.
But my question is what the findings were.
Yes.
And is you agree that under the standard the district court, among other things, has to find that there's a likelihood of success on the merits? And is a finding of a serious question equivalent to saying
for purposes of Washington law, which is what we're now talking about in terms of this alternative ground, yes, I think the way he's phrased this in his order, meet a legal standard for upholding the imposition of a preliminary injunction under Washington law. Yes, I do.
Mr. Christie, just two questions.
In terms
of the claim, the patent side of the issue of the case, what claims are is it the two independent claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
1 and 12?
Yes.
Okay. And the other question, you recall that at the end of Mr. Coulter's argument, there was some discussion about what the present status is. Do you agree with what he said, namely that there was a PI, then it was removed, then it was put back in place, and now there is a restraint in place against his client?
Yes, and I'd like to clarify
with
that.
With respect to patent infringement?
The clarification would be this. In the preliminary order, in Judge Burgess's order at page 13, this is at page 13 as well in the appendix, he outlines four separate areas of relief. And they included returning materials, returning documents, et sending a notice out to potential customers about that the device may well be in violation. So it was substantially broader than simply don't market, don't sell.
Right. Oh, no. I didn't
but but currently, yes. Judge Burgess, as a result of a motion that we made when we obtained information about representations that Mr. McKay was making in the marketplace, we brought on a motion to prevent him from doing that
further. So you agree with Mr. Coulter that at this time his client is preliminarily enjoined from marketing and selling his product,
yes.
Whatever else, whatever, regardless of what other constraints may be on.
Yes, sir.
Can I just get clarified? Two quick points.
Absolutely.
One is, so the date, we've all conceded that as of now, at least the covenant not to sue is not in effect. Do you agree? Somebody said November. It expired in November.
I actually think the date is a little bit earlier than that based on what's in this record. And that comes from Mr. Harrington's testimony that the end of his relationship, his last paycheck to Mr. McKay, if you will, was in June, and I can get the specific date, but it was in June of 04, and you would run the 3 years mm-hmm. from that date.
And then just on the patent misuse question that I asked Mr. Coulter, it was a little less than clear to me, particularly if the district court judge didn't deal with it, that patent misuse had been appropriately raised below. Do you have any view on that?
I noted your question, and I looked through the judge's order. If you look at page 5 of that order, there is some brief language that really summarizes the extent to which there was any discussion of that. His order on page 5 in the appendix at 5 has this paragraph, second from the bottom. Okay, but there's issues raised in his brief that relate to improper marking of a prototype device. That's the subject of a separate lawsuit that's now pending before Judge Peckman in the Western District. In fact, we moved to consolidate it with this action, and that motion has been opposed. So that's the current state on that issue.
Thank you.
Does the court have any other questions? If not, I'll yield the balance of my time back to the court.
Thank you, Mr. Christie.
Thank you.
Mr. Coulter, you have a little over 2 minutes
remaining. Thank you. Just a couple of points of clarification. We keep talking about reverse engineering and copying, and those are doctrines that apply to trade secret. This is a patent. The patent is patent. Anyone can go and read it, and someone of ordinary skill in the art can and could engineer it. There's no need to reverse engineer it, and it didn't need any trade secret information. If there were any trade secret information, it was destroyed by filing a patent. Second point of clarification I'd like to make is that the Washington supplemental law questions that were heard by the district court, plaintiff tried to remove those to Island County, Washington, so only the Washington issues could be heard by that court. And that court stated pending resolution of this appeal as well.
Wait, I'm sorry, the state court, the plaintiff tried to remove that issue to a state court, and the state court ruled on it?
Yes, Your Honor, they ruled to stay it pending resolution of this matter. So after this court decides, then we can move to reopen in Island County, and all of the state law claims will be heard. We won't oppose them being moved there, obviously, and only the patent issue will be left.
But the state law claims are currently before the federal district court.
Correct, but they moved to the federal district court to release those claims to the state court so that the state court would hear the state claims and the federal court would hear only the patent claim. Just to underscore the patent misuse argument that we tried to raise, we had these lanterns with us, all of these, in the courtroom, and we pointed out that this is falsely marked, violation of Section 292, patents pending, 1999. That's 5 years before they applied for the patent. At the very least, that raises the question that he knew that he had a patentable invention that was on sale and barred as to its patentability because be falsely marked, and they were selling it, and we presented evidence to show that they were selling it. At the very least, that should raise the question of the invalidity of the patent and patent misuse. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Coulter.
All rise.